Disc golf's influence and reach is largely thanks to the market reach of Wham-O, the single company that had the hula hoop, the Super Ball, and of course, the Frisbee. Ed Hedrick recruited a network of Frisbee players to sell his discs, then had the International Frisbee Association. First with its newsletter under its beloved reclusive director, Harvey J. Kutkuk, and then Dan Stork Roddick in 1976, who started the North American Series along with associated international tournaments in Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and Sweden to build competition and spread the different disc disciplines worldwide. We know California as the epicenter of disc golf in the world, but Stork had dedicated partners everywhere that Frisbee flourished. There was at least a local pro at one course in nearly every state in the lower 48, but the real driving force in an area tended to be the regional IFA director, who typically had been Hedrick's regional sales rep for Wham-O and then DGA, thanks to Stork's desire to keep the Frisbee family close.
I made pretty much every effort I could to kind of keep the band together.
Stork believed in strength in numbers, supported every disc discipline, and even invented a few new ones. The various sports associations of Guts, Ultimate, and Freestyle eventually split off from overall tournaments to go their separate ways. But disc golf actually started a little earlier with two major forces: Stork coming in as IFA director, and Hedrick transitioning away from Wham-O to found DGA and later the PDGA. The two sides complemented each other and collaborated heavily with regional pros. In this episode, we get special insight into the early days of Frisbee and disc golf in the South, with one of the first people to make a living with plastic discs, who had his own part in spreading disc sports across the nation and brought that passion back to Alabama to compete and grow the sport he loves. I'm Gabe LeBounty. Join me once again as we explore the roots of flight. The PDGA and the IFA had a symbiotic relationship. In the earliest days of the International Frisbee Association, when Stork was still trying to place the North American Series meets, he sought out cities with disc golf courses, which made fertile ground to grow disc sports and later attract interest in the pole hole baskets.
Because it was my theory that we had strength in those numbers. And it was pretty easy early in the going because, frankly, almost everybody who was interested in playing was interested in playing everything. And of course, we were trying to place them in spots where we knew there were enthusiasts or clubs, like Minnesota had MFA, was a very early club that had courses. So that was a natural host for NAS meets. We had an NAS meet in Seattle. We had them in Northern California. We had San Diego. We had in Arizona, pretty much scattered the map. Alabama, Tom Monroe, all of those early people. That was my first phone call of Tom. We're thinking of having a series meet down there. Do you think you can pull one off?
Stork's first phone call to a Frisbee legend who was there before the beginning.
Tom Monroe, PDGA number 33, almost 75. I was there before the beginning. We lived in San Diego in 63, 64. That's where I first saw guys playing with a Frisbee at Scripps Laboratory in La Jolla. I was amazed at them playing catch with what looked like a plate. So I went down and we threw a couple and I really liked it. I was a baseball player all my life and thought that, well, this is fun.
You can't trace disc sports back in the South without Tom Monroe, PDGA number 033, a world champion in Frisbee sports and disc golf, and an inaugural Disc Golf Hall of Famer. He first traveled the country putting on Frisbee demonstrations for WAMO, becoming one of the first people to be paid for disc performance. Tom technically came from the California tradition of Frisbee, having first tossed a disc around in San Diego. But his love of Frisbee didn't get started until later, when disc golf was reaching its first turning point.
And then we moved back to Huntsville, Alabama, and I didn't see a Frisbee again until I got to college. My roommate Dan just happened to have an old black Master Frisbee in his suitcase, and we started throwing that around in the parking lot of our apartments. And being the guys that we were, we would constantly try to out-trick each other by making trick throws and trick catches, mm-hmm. and wore that Frisbee out.
Tom played Frisbee all through college and went on to play a pre-NAS Frisbee tournament in Atlanta, Georgia, put on by the local radio station WQXI. And this is where he really caught the bug, right before Hedrick's transition to the PDGA. He credits his light bulb moment to his girlfriend at the time, and soon after found himself back in California.
After returning from Atlanta and winning that big tournament, I knew I was a little bit better than everybody else. And I constantly was looking for people to play with, and there weren't that many in Florence, Alabama. I did find a couple guys to throw with, and I would just go out into a yard and throw what I didn't know was MTA at the time. I just threw the Frisbee as high as I could and catch it when it came down really fast, mm-hmm. Because it had a small yard to throw in. And I had a girlfriend at the time that was really getting upset that I was spending more time with the Frisbee than I was with her. And so she said, well, if you like that so much, why don't you get a job with that company? And I went, ding. The light bulb went off in my head. I wrote a letter to WAMO. They referred me to the International Frisbee Association. And by chance, I found myself in California a few months later, and I walked into Ed Hedrick's office. He actually sent a car to get me. I was staying with my parents. I walked into Ed's office, and we sat there talking. He was telling me about all his plans for Frisbee players, which was just, you know, what I wanted to hear. Told me he wanted to see people like me make a living out of playing Frisbee because we deserved it because we were so good, blah, blah, blah. He told me that they had just had the 1974 World Frisbee Championships in the Rose Bowl. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, shoot, Ed, if I'd known about that, I would have come. He says, oh, son, you've got to be invited. You just can't come. I said, well, I'll be here next year.
Uh-huh. He was there the next year. When Tom got back from that tournament in Atlanta, he was still practicing in his backyard. And as chance would have it, he found other Frisbee players to meet up with and start playing. And after he met with Hedrick, he knew he had to set up somewhere to practice golf.
I was riding around town on my bicycle after coming back from Atlanta, and I just happened to catch out of the corner of my eye a couple guys playing Frisbee in a backyard mm-hmm. somewhere. All I did was I saw a Frisbee fly by and somebody catch it. I whipped around the middle of the street, rode right back in there, and met them, played with them, and we all met on campus the next day. Going back to when I met Ed Hedrick, one of the first things I did when I got back to campus was design a Frisbee golf course around campus. Mm-hmm. And now we had something to do as a group.
Right.
And every day we'd meet at like 4 o'clock and play Frisbee golf around campus. We had targets like a stop sign. We had this one target that was a Civil War headstone in the ground. And we had telephone poles and trash cans that stayed there all the time. And mm-hmm. of course, the same tee off every day. And as people saw us doing that, they wanted to come in and play with us. You know, well, this looks like fun. What are y'all doing?
Yeah.
Well, here, have a Frisbee. Let's go.
And so the Florence Frisbee team was born. Tom would eventually rise high enough to get a van and start touring shows for WAMO. But in college, it was all about going to tournaments and competing in the various Frisbee events.
WAMO gave us traveling money. And when I say us, I mean the Florence Frisbee team, the FFT. And there were like anywhere from 4 to 8 or 10 of us that would travel to tournaments up in New Jersey. We went to the Guts Championship up in Upper Michigan, Copper Harbor. Other tournaments around the country. We went to Boulder that summer and Minneapolis, Rochester, wherever there was a big Frisbee tournament, we'd go to it. But I still didn't have the van yet, so I'm hitching rides with people and getting there one way or the other. We did pretty good at that. And then myself and my buddy Mike Collins of the Florence Frisbee team, had enough points at these tournaments that we were invited to go to the World Frisbee Championships in 75.
After the 1975 World Frisbee Championship, Hedrick directed Tom to a couple of other Frisbee legends, where he received the inspiration for the next way he would grow the sport.
Ed Hedrick had told me to find John Kirkland and Victor Malafrani, who were touring with the Globetrotters. They were doing a halftime show for the Globetrotters, and that was like an all-year-long thing. And I met them first in Memphis, and I told them, Ed sent me. I said, well, come on in. And we're sitting there talking. I'd seen their show, and they were just full of great tricks and high skill level performance. And John Kirkland showed me the next new thing in freestyle, besides trick catches and throws, was the nail delay, where the Frisbee would spin on your fingernail. And he showed me how to do that. About 2 months later, they were in Atlanta. I rode my motorcycle over to Atlanta to see them do their show again, and went backstage with them into their dressing room, and I could do the nail delay. And he said he'd never seen anybody learn it so fast.
Shortly after, Tom got that call from Stork and became IFA's regional director in the South. Tom knew he had to get Frisbee shows like Kirkland's and Malafrante's going regularly, and also knew other IFA-associated clubs had vans to travel around in. And he eventually got one of his own and customized it for travel and disc storage, all on Wham-O's dime. As part of Stork's push to get Frisbee into schools and inspire the next generation of Frisbee players, Tom got to work on a busy schedule.
For like 2 years in the wintertime, we did Frisbee shows at assembly programs in public schools throughout the Midwest. We did 3 shows a day, 5 days a week. And on the last show, our check would be waiting for us. And then we'd find the nearest Holiday Inn and spend the weekend and try to unwind from that rigorous touring schedule. But we got really good at freestyle, and we got good at talking to a crowd on the microphone and controlling everything and making it work. And we got our show down just like clockwork.
The focus wasn't just on secondary schools. Disc sports had gained a foothold at colleges across America, and Wham-O didn't neglect that market at all.
After touring and doing shows in the winter, in the spring, we got hooked up with the Association of College Unions, which was a big convention they had every year in like early winter, January, something like that. Mm-hmm. And we would get a booth and sell our Frisbee show right next to rock groups selling their acts. You know, magicians, comedians, everybody's trying to get into the collegiate spring fling programs. Because every college, every spring has a week where they just have like festival.
Those spring fling events planted seeds for a lot of the next generation of disc golf players and disc sports organizers. But there's no rest for the weary. In addition to his touring duties, Tom was also running the Alabama State IFA Championship, a precursor to the North American Series.
Jump in and run the state tournaments throughout the South. And that's about the time the International Frisbee Association got started with running the North American Series. And we would travel to those tournaments all around the country and earn points to go back to the Rose Bowl again. And so there was like, I don't know, 8 or 10 years that it was nonstop every day.
Putting on all these demonstrations and running the state tournaments meant Tom was making more money with disc sports than almost anyone else. Although the Florence Frisbee team and a few other clubs did traveling Frisbee shows paid by Wham-O, there were only a few people carving the niche of disc sports deeper into their areas. Some disc golf tournaments have grown to boast a large staff for running events, but in a lot of areas, it's like it was in the beginning. Just a few individuals making it happen.
As we traveled around, since we were this club from Alabama, we were the first people from the South to go to all these tournaments. Most of them were up in the North, the Northeast, and throughout the Midwest. They were like a year or so ahead of us in terms of clubs and organization. Mm-hmm. And so we would be invited to stay with a lot of those people.
Right.
And then we'd find out that every town who had a Frisbee club in an organization, there was usually one or two people that were behind it all and kept it going and made it happen. It's, I'm sure it's like that all over the country right now, where you've got one or two movers and shakers, and then everybody else might come to a work day or might come to a club meeting. You know, you get your core people that'll do all the work, and they're the ones who really make it happen. And that's what Frisbee was. It was a grassroots movement all around the country in the mid-70s, late 70s, to make these tournaments happen and legitimize the whole sport.
The next disc golf destination in the South would see Tom traveling back to Atlanta to play events put on by the one person shouldering the majority of the work in Georgia, who came to Frisbee from the catering business.
And he brought the first puppies to the South. And then he met Patty Kunkel here in Huntsville. And then they started living together in Atlanta. And John was responsible for the first disc golf courses and the tournaments in Atlanta. And one of those early courses was already there. It was in Chastain Park. And that's where they had horses riding through, coming through the park. And there were nine holes in the ground. He put up nine more temporary holes and had a great tournament there. It was just, there were just too many people in the park, and they had to pull the targets.
Gotcha,
and then he found other places. He could always find a place to put in a temp course. He'd find private property on people's land and put in courses. He hosted some big tournaments in Atlanta. He had the World Seniors overalls twice there over the years, and they didn't really have much of a club. They just had John doing everything. He would put courses in the ground and then run the tournaments. And they had a little Frisbee store in an area called Little Five Points. I think there's a Little Five Points in every big city in America where all the hippies hang out. They had a store that sold Frisbees and all kinds of things. It was like the Grateful Dead headquarters in Atlanta. It, you know, if it hadn't been for John David, disc golf would be years behind the rest of the country as far as disc golf and John go. But he made it happen in Atlanta, and we're glad he did.
John David is another Hall of Famer in the three-digit club at PDGA number 790. And though he was putting on disc golf events well into the 80s, Frisbee in Georgia also had another landmark event for the other big disc sport.
Atlanta was the next big Frisbee mecca, if you will. They took off in ultimate. Atlanta's always had great ultimate teams. As a matter of fact, the club in Atlanta hosted the first money payout ultimate tournament. And that was, I think that was in 79. It was a big year for me. And it was outside the fields of Georgia Tech, right outside the football stadium where everybody parks for the football games. And there were like a dozen teams from all over the country. And I was asked to be on an all-star team.
The tournament had its fair share of ultimate-only teams, but this all-star team was made up of overall Frisbee players from the region.
But we were really good disc handlers because we knew how to freestyle and play guts and all that type of thing. And so we gelled really well, and we ended up winning the tournament. And I think we won $2,500 and, you know, split that up with 15 people. Woohoo!
Right.
And then at the end of the tournament, we went into the Georgia Tech football stadium and had distance competition. And since we won, we'd already popped the champagne and started drinking it. And then somebody said, "Hey, let's go. We got to throw distance now." I said, "What?" Distance. So I came in second instead of first.
While John got Frisbee and disc golf up and running in Atlanta, Tom saw the same story being told across all the southern states.
And then there were people like him around the country, you know, like Charlotte had some movers and shakers, and that was a big Frisbee golf and disc golf town, and it still is today. They've had the world championships three times. And, you know, just about everywhere you can trace it back to like one or two people that had the initiative to love it enough to make it happen. And a great sacrifice to themselves. A lot of people, you know, gave up careers just to pursue Frisbee.
Just ask Snapper Pearson. Some people were giving up jobs and dedicating their lives to Frisbee, but it didn't gain as much of a foothold in every single state. Mississippi and Louisiana were basically one and done for a while.
Mississippi had one big overall state tournament because one of our guys from the Florence Frisbee team went to graduate school over in Oxford. And after he left there, it kind of fizzled out. Louisiana, Shreveport, there was a guy, Brian Hayes, who was a mover and shaker. And there was a huge course down there, Clyde Faint course, on a big four-lane road. It had one lane going one way on one side, another lane going the other side, and it was lit at night, and they had 27 holes. So you could play all night long.
Just from the light from the road.
Yeah. Well, the whole, the big road lights, they were over the park. And he had a couple of big tournaments there, and that was like the biggest tournament just west of the Mississippi. Louisiana didn't have much more going on after that, or Mississippi, until the Southern Nationals started, and they were the ones who really kickstarted disc golf in Mississippi.
Don't worry, we'll get into Southern Nationals, but that's at least a whole episode by itself. In contrast to Mississippi and Louisiana, Tennessee and Florida were two of the other areas to really embrace disc golf and produce some great disc athletes.
Then up in Little Rock, Ted Smithers organized some tournaments, and they had a nice course in North Little Rock. Memphis had some little tournaments going on. Nashville has grown into a huge disc golf town. They were a little slow to get started. We had some great tournaments up there at the Parthenon, which is a replica of the Parthenon.
Right.
and it's in a huge park. And we had a frisbee golf course marked out around it, hitting different trees and whatnot. We did freestyle on Sunday afternoon, and the park is packed every Sunday afternoon when the weather's nice. And we'd have like 5,000 or 6,000 people watching the freestyle finals. And then Atlanta, they had some big tournaments that John ran in Piedmont Park, which is a huge park. That's where in the early 70s we used to watch the Allman Brothers play for free before they were famous in Piedmont Park. Florida, there was a guy in Jacksonville, Ken Cook. He ran some tournaments in Jacksonville, and then he moved and got married or something and quit doing that. And then down in Sarasota, Jeff Watson, his brother, and some of their friends ran some big tournaments down there for a few years. Jeff Watson was the biggest winner of the year in 83. He won the open division of the 83 Worlds here in Huntsville, and then went out to California and won World Frisbee Golf out there. And he was the big winner. He took all his earnings and went back to Sarasota and opened a t-shirt silk screen place. Quit playing frisbee. He was really good.
I guess Jeff thought it would be best to get out while he was ahead. Unfortunately for disc golf in Jacksonville, not everyone who saw opportunity in disc sports was in it honestly.
One of the worst things that happened, but there was a guy in Jacksonville, Florida, who convinced the city parks department to have the freestyle tournament in, I think it's called the Gator Bowl, where they have the Florida-Georgia game every year. And he convinced the parks department into doing that and printing up a bunch of t-shirts and a bunch of ultimate or freestyle discs with this logo on it. And then all these freestyle players came because he promised a huge prize pot. And then at the last minute, he disappeared with everything. And that just soured the city of Jacksonville on all things frisbee. So it took years and years before a disc golf course could go in. And one of my old friends, Dan Berman, RIP, bought 18 targets and put them in a park just to convince the city that disc golf would work. And after 2 or 3 years, they finally paid him for the targets. So he convinced them that disc golf would work. And then Jacksonville's been going strong ever since then.
PDGA number 2765, Dan passed away in 2017, but he had a huge impact on the sport, putting on frisbee demonstrations like Tom, designing and building disc golf courses around the U.S., and he also set the indoor distance record in 2005 that still stands today.
So it was like, you know, wherever there was somebody with the wherewithal to make it happen, made it happen.
Right.
And they'd usually have a core of people around them that would help out.
Disc golf wasn't always a point event in the North American series, but in the South, it was. This, along with the 1 to 2 people running things in each state, ensured courses went in across the South, and if they didn't stick, the interest in golf would, giving rise to more courses.
Every place that we had a state tournament, which was all the southern states and usually the biggest cities in each state, like Nashville and Huntsville and Atlanta, whatnot, we'd put up a Frisbee golf course. Mm-hmm. And that would be one of the things you do in the overall tournaments. And we arranged it so you'd play the first round Saturday morning and the second round Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. That way you had to stay for the whole weekend and do the other events. We'd finish off the weekend with freestyle because that was the most popular. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, everybody there had to play Frisbee golf to get points for that overall position. And so people would play Frisbee golf and say, John Dave in Atlanta, let's go home and do that at where we live.
Various disc diehards were making Frisbee happen in their states. And meanwhile, Tom was seeing everything from a bird's eye view. The IFA sent out a regular newsletter that helped bring Frisbee players a little closer in the years before the internet. And Tom started his own periodical, focusing on the South. This gave players and organizers a greater sense of purpose and carved the niche a little deeper with exclusive access to the best discs.
There were some newsletters back then. The IFA had a newsletter, and then each part of the country had our own. The one in the South was called the South's Sailing Circular. And I had a picture of a scene of the shuttle flying by dropping a bunch of Frisbees on the Southeast. And that was our main means of communication with all the Frisbee players in the Southeast. I would write it and then somebody would type it up and we'd fold it up into a threefold and put a staple and a stamp on it and mail it out. And we had a mailing list. This is before computers could print out labels. So we had to do everything by hand. It was usually a write-up of the tournaments that we'd had since the last newsletter, mm-hmm. and a schedule of the tournaments that were coming up. And there was, of course, a place in it where you could mail order discs that mm-hmm. you couldn't get anywhere else. Like there was a great Frisbee called an HDX, and it was the original candy plastic. It was a 165-gram Frisbee made out of this super high-tech material that was great for freestyle or just throwing in the trees in the wintertime because you couldn't break them. That's the only place that you could buy these particular discs because they didn't sell them to stores. They only sold them to Frisbee players. And, you know, we'd list the tournaments and people would come. And the more tournaments we had, the bigger it would grow, the more people would come to it. And it just kind of expanded from like 75 to 85 exponentially throughout the South and the rest of the country. Because when we go to the big tournaments, there's always people from all over the country there.
Newsletters provided a sense of community around disc sports, and courses going in the ground spread disc golf all across the South. Tom landed in Huntsville in 1976 and immediately set to work looking for somewhere to put on a course. He ended up with one of the oldest courses still in the ground, second only to Oak Grove, Bronze Springs Park.
Pasadena Oak Grove is the first one, mm-hmm. and it's still there. And then Bronze Springs is the second oldest one that's still in the ground. There were lots of them. Ed Hedrick, when he formed the Disc Golf Association and PDGA and invented the target, he convinced WAMO into putting 9 whole courses in the major market areas in America, New York, Atlanta, San Francisco, mm-hmm. Miami, whatever, wherever they could put a course. Not every city had a park that they could just throw in a 9-hole Frisbee golf course. But he did that, and a lot of those were pulled because they were ahead of their time. The park grew around them and they didn't have room for these Frisbees flying around and the horses coming through.
Tom originally designed the Bronze Springs course to wrap around the park through land that has since become home to other types of recreation. Tom wanted to use this land to make a course for the long arms.
Originally, I designed 18 holes at Bronze Springs that went around the whole park. Mm-hmm. You know, back then I was like all the big arms. I wanted big, long throws. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what's in the park now wasn't there in 75, 76. Mm-hmm. And I had the last few holes going through the pine trees. And then I went to a tournament in Canada and Ed came to town, stayed at my house. And wanted to make sure that the sale, the targets went through and make sure he got the check mm-hmm. from the Parks Department. And they showed him my design and they went all the way around the park and then came back through the pine trees. There was an old logging trail that went through there. And it was so thick with pine trees, you couldn't see through it. Right. It was just dark. The canopy was so thick. But they took him through there. He said, well, this is great. We'll put all 18 holes in here. And I came back to town and heard about this. They said, what? The one that's there now, mm-hmm. I think it might just be under 5,000 feet, mm-hmm. you know, right, yeah. a little less than a mile. And the one I had was about 2 miles.
Tom was way ahead of his time with a 10,000 plus foot course, something I've only heard of twice for upper tier modern disc golf events. And if Hedrick hadn't come in and shortened the design, I imagine it could have gotten pulled for the same reasons a lot of other early courses did. As a regional IFA director, and later regional rep for DGA and the PDGA, Tom saw the roots on a more local level, but he also saw the larger movements that brought disc sports together and split them apart. Disc golf started to differentiate a little earlier than other sports when Hedrick started specializing equipment and took a page from the World Frisbee Championship for his first big tournament.
That would be when Ed came out with the Midnight Flyers. He convinced WAMO into having the $50,000 mm-hmm. Frisbee golf tournament out in Huntington Beach. And you had to be a PDJ member to qualify. And word got out in the Frisbee world of all the players that this was happening. And I ran the qualifying tournament here in Huntsville. And other people around the country ran qualifying tournaments. And you had to be in like the top 5 or 10 to right. be invited to go to this thing. The membership jumped, boom, exploded mm-hmm. right then right. and there. And that helped bring Frisbee golf more into the forefront. I really think that one thing that killed the overall tournaments was that if you really wanted to be good in ultimate mm-hmm. or frisbee golf, that's what you had to concentrate on. You couldn't be messing around with freestyle and MTA right. and any other of the events. If you wanted to really be good, you had to dedicate yourself to one sport or the other. There were some of us that continued to be good in all the sports, but it was like freestyle became a dying art because mm-hmm. it is so hard to do. Right. It takes so much practice, especially if you're going to work up a routine with someone else. It has to be like a gymnastics routine right. or Olympic type stuff. More and more people found out that disc golf and frisbee golf is a whole lot easier to play. And you know, there's a whole another breed of people that want to run and throw and catch, and that's mm-hmm. those are your ultimate players. And you just couldn't, there weren't a whole lot of really good ultimate players who played disc golf and vice versa.
The beginning of the end for overall play occurred when WAMO was sold to Mattel in 1984, when for a time, Barbie owned Frisbee. With larger corporate overseers, Frisbee suddenly wasn't worth the expense, and money started getting pulled from the big overall events. Overall's play still happens in various state tournaments still running today, but in 1985, player organizations had formed and all met one last time in Rutgers, New York.
The first thing Mattel did when they bought WAMO was to cancel that World Frisbee Championship. We're not going to pay for 100 Frisbee players to come to California and spend mm-hmm. a week. What are you talking about?
Right.
So we had the last World Championship up at Rutgers, and it was affectionately called the Rut Bowl instead of the Rose Bowl. And we had a big meeting with Stork, and everybody pretty much agreed to form our own independent organization, like the Ultimate Players Association, the UPA, mm-hmm. and the Professional Disc Golf Association. Ed had already done that, but you know, we're taking over disc golf. And then the Guts Players Association, the Freestyle Players Association. Mm-hmm. And within those associations, they would have their own tournaments mm-hmm. and their own world championships, not funded by WAMO anymore because there, right. there wasn't a WAMO anymore. Mm-hmm. And so that's how the PDGA and the UPA started growing. The FPA, Freestyle Players, they kind of struggled along, even though they have an organization now, but it's not nearly as big as it could be.
Tom Monroe affected immense change and had a guiding hand in disc golf since before it was disc golf. He was one of the few to tour the U.S., bringing disc sports to countless new players. He got in early and worked at it nonstop for a decade. As an IFA regional director, he had perspectives on both the local scene in the South and the national side of the sport. And when the disc discipline split, Tom stuck with Ed Hedrick in the PDGA. Soon after, he would influence disc golf nationally, as half of the duo that would spearhead the first disc golf tour along with Ted Smethers. And just a year later, standing up to Hedrick while running the 1983 PDGA World Championship in his hometown of Huntsville, he opened up the tournament to all approved discs, which allowed the first beveled edge disc to take flight. Along with a small team of dedicated individuals, he grew disc golf across the South not only by running tournaments, but by collaborating with directors in other states, running a regional newsletter that brought players together with news and new discs, and planting seeds that would grow into courses, great players, and tournament directors. To put it simply, Tom isn't in the Disc Golf Hall of Fame's inaugural 1993 class for nothing. While it may have had some hiccups like Jacksonville, disc golf in the South has a strong tradition of great players and brought a different approach to the national scene with ultimate players and their power forehand drives, and courses like Bronze Springs forcing tight lines through clustered pines. With the roots dug deep across the region, we'll continue to see quality events run and great players like Matt Oram and Chris Dickerson, not to mention the champ himself, come out of the South and add their voices to the roots of our sport. This was the second of two episodes this season on geographically specific origins of disc golf. Disc golf roots were deep in overall competition, but from that wide array of disc disciplines, only disc golf and ultimate have grown participation beyond the numbers they had during the overall days. In episode 3, we'll take a look at what disc golf has in common with the other disciplines and what makes it stand out. Be sure to tune into Roots of Flight on the Disc Golf Network, where Brian Earhart and I discuss and take a bit of a deeper look into a few topics from each episode, exclusively on the Disc Golf Network. If you aren't yet a DGN subscriber, you can get access to this recap show, the 2021 Hall of Fame induction ceremony, an interview with Stork about Oak Grove Park, and great shows like Scratch to Scratch. Oh, and live coverage of all Elite Series disc golf events, and for as little as $3 a month if you're a PDGA member. This podcast was created, written, and produced by me, Gabe LeBounty, in consultation with Andy Young and Jeff Homburg, and is distributed by the Disc Golf Network. Logo is by Alyssa Ann. You can find her on Instagram, at InkWitchLiss. Roots of Flight is produced in collaboration with the Disc Golf Hall of Fame, with the shared goal of ensuring the rich history of the game is preserved for the future. To learn more about the Hall of Fame and how you can support their mission, please visit thediscgolfhalloffame.com. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on more of the story of disc golf. If you like the show, leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. It would really help lead disc golfers to the history of the sport. You can find Roots of Flight on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever podcasts are sold. You can also find Roots of Flight on Twitter and Instagram, at Roots of Flight, to catch announcements on new episodes, polls, and some interesting clips that don't make it into the final episodes. You can find me on Twitter at GGDiscGolf and on Instagram at GrizzlyGingerDG. Join me here next time as we explore the roots of flight.